Can we get going then, everybody? If everybody is settled. Sorry, it's a bit hot in here. I'm still thinking about whether to shift the Peacock Theatre or not, because there are a lot of people in the overflow room, I think. Say hello to them somehow or other. But I might not shift, because it's just getting much more contact with the audience thing in here than you do in the big lecture theatre. It is very hot though, isn't it? There's supposed to be air conditioning in here, actually. Ecologically sound air conditioning is supposed to be. Well, I hope it's not too much of an ordeal then, this lecture. Anyway, thanks to everyone for coming again. Can I just, as a starter, as a lead-in from the last lecture, the main topic that I want to cover in this lecture is the impact today of globalization. Recognizing that the term globalization is a complex and controversial term in a way in which I'll explain. Going back to the discussion of modernity, though, last time, the Enlightenment philosophers, the main thinkers who founded the key dynamics of modernity, had a specific idea about the world, which in our time has turned out to be either wrong or deeply flawed. The basic sort of thrust of Enlightenment was the idea that the more we get to know about the world, the more we can control and harness it to human purposes. The whole point of the Enlightenment, and therefore the kind of cultural dynamic of modernity, is the idea that if we break with tradition, if we break with dogma, if we break with the past, we can shape the world. Marx, Karl Marx, was in some ways the key figure who inherited this perspective in the 19th century, and Marxism it was which shaped a good deal of the 20th century under the impact of this notion. Marx argued we have to know our history in order to make history. Through understanding our history, we can control our destiny as human beings. A fundamental Enlightenment idea. And it's on the face of it very plausible. If we get to know more about nature through the natural sciences, why can't we hope to control nature? If we get to know more about ourselves through the social sciences, why can't we direct our own lives towards a more humane future? That is the thrust of Marxism. In that sense, Marxism should be seen not as a critical opposition to Enlightenment, but as the key dynamic of Enlightenment. Marxism shaped much of the 20th century through the use of this theorem. But this theorem has turned out to be wrong. Or at least, it's produced a world where Enlightenment, the inheritance of Enlightenment, is much more fractured, much more difficult, much more problematic than most of us, including Marx, ever imagined it would be. We live in a world of newly created uncertainties, and I have a particular terminology for these uncertainties, and to some degree this is a theme that will run through all the lectures. I call it manufactured uncertainty or manufactured risk. I want to separate this from external uncertainty or external risk. Manufactured uncertainty is uncertainty produced by the very dynamic of Enlightenment itself. Just to put it simply, because I'll come back to these themes in a subsequent lecture, it's perfectly plain, I think, in the closing years of the 20th century that science and technology, although they do allow us to control our lives in some respects much more effectively than ever before, at the same time, they are at the origin of some of the deep uncertainties which we face. The involvement of science and technology, modern industry in the world, has created, for example, the debate about global warming. Global warming is a new environment of uncertainty. It's not like external nature. It is nature which has felt the impact of human scientific and technological development. Put simply, one can say that for hundreds of years, human beings worried about what nature can do to us in the form of earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, bad harvests, and so forth. That's what I call external risk, risk coming from external nature. Somewhere, only in the last several decades, I think, we started worrying less about what nature can do to us and more about what we've done to nature. When you make that transition, you're making a transition to a world of manufactured uncertainty, a world which the Enlightenment did not predict, a world which is bound up with the collapse of Marxism, a world which I'll be discussing in the next lecture, is also bound up with the disintegration of Soviet communism. That world is certainly the legatee of the Enlightenment, but the Enlightenment has produced a diversity of uncertainties which come from the actual accumulation of human knowledge. What the Enlightenment philosophers did not foresee is that the accumulation of human knowledge, whether it be in respect of science and technology, or whether it be in respect of knowledge about ourselves, creates new environments of uncertainty, much more difficult to resolve in a way than traditional ones, because they are historically unique. Global warming, if it is indeed produced by human intervention into nature, has not occurred before. Part of the dilemma about the new risk environments is that we just don't know how risky they are, or whether indeed the risks are new at all. There is a debate about global warming about that. All this is the kind of background parameter, really, to the legacy of Enlightenment for us. Modernity, such as I described it last time, has proved to be much more complex, much more fractured, and in a way much more inadequate, really, than the philosophers of Enlightenment ever believed. And we have to cope with those problems. And I want to spend a good deal of this lecture indicating what some of those problems are. Now, if you ask why the world has changed, why, for example, Marxism lasted for 100 or so years and now has collapsed, why are there new forms of uncertainty around? It's a big issue, but it is deeply bound up, I want to claim anyway, with the impact of globalization. And that's why globalization, study of globalization, is the main thematic of what I want to talk about today. Now, the term globalization is really interesting. Only about 10 years ago, you'll find that hardly anyone used the term at all. Very difficult to find anyone employing the term globalization, even only 10 years ago. Now, of course, the term is everywhere. Politicians use it. Business people talk about it. Open your newspaper, you find discussion of the impact of globalization. From becoming a word that nobody used, it's become a word that everybody uses. It's a dangerous thing, because like postmodernism, if it's used widely enough, no one in the end quite knows what it means. And the word tends to be an empty one, which you just use rhetorically. Now, I think the impact of globalization is fundamental. I think it is something quite new. It does relate to the early development of modernity in a way in which I'll try to show. But the controversy about globalization is, I think, where it's at in the social sciences. This is the cutting-edge debate, really. Not just in the social sciences, but I think in politics and in industrial development too. Now, because the term has become to be used so commonly, there is already a controversy about it. And I think the best way into a discussion of globalization is first of all to look a bit at that controversy. Two quite different positions have developed over the past 10 years about what globalization is and what its consequences might be. Quite different, quite opposed positions. We can call them, following the writings of the political scientist David Held, I put David Held's book down the book list, if you remember last time. It's called Models of Democracy. But he's moved on more recently to study globalization in detail. He draws a very useful distinction between the people he calls the globalization skeptics, on the one hand, the globalization skeptics, I'll put these in quotes because it's his sort of invention, and the hyperglobalizers on the other. Hyperglobalizers on the other. Key figures among the globalization skeptics, the book to look at off the book list from last time is Paul Hurst and Graham Thompson. Their book called Globalization in Question. Globalization in Question. Key figure among the hyper-globalizers is the Japanese writer Kenichi Omai, whose book called The End of the Nation State, or one of his books I also put on the book list last time. The globalization skeptics, what do they say? Well, the globalization skeptics argue that although the term globalization is everywhere, as I just mentioned, in fact, the processes of globalization have not proceeded very far. They are skeptical of the very idea of globalization, if you like. Key argument of writers like Hurst and Thompson is that if you look back to the late 19th century, there you find very high levels of international trade. You find big migration movements of population at that time, the late 19th century, early 20th century. You find big trade in currencies at that time, kind of financial trading. And they say the current period, that is the last 20 or so years, is not different from the late 19th century. Therefore, according to them, the whole idea of globalization is actually an ideology. It is an ideology essentially of right-wing free market enthusiasts, they say. There's been the guiding ideology of privatization of enterprise and of the claims of many governments to be encouraging markets over the past two or so decades. Most of the talk, though, about globalization, according to them, is empty rhetoric. Now, this is very important because the people who are globalization skeptics tend to be on the old social democratic left, tend to be, as Hurst and Thompson are. And you can see why there is a kind of conformity between this political position and skepticism about globalization. Because if you believe that nothing much has changed, if you believe that all the talk of the global marketplace and all that stuff is just misplaced, well then you can say we can go on as before. And that is indeed what Hurst and Hindus tend to say. For example, people who believe in the impact of globalization say there is a crisis facing the welfare state. Hurst and Thompson tend to argue, as against that, there is no structural crisis of the welfare state. We can continue with the old welfare state mechanisms. We can continue with a social democratic program. We don't really have to worry about globalization except as an ideology. We can preserve, if you like, old leftism or the social democratic project intact because most of this is just hype. Oh my, and the hyper-globalizers have the opposite position. For them, globalization is so far advanced that it is more or less complete already. Oh my, you remember, I mentioned his other book last time, I think, speaks of the borderless economy. According to Oh my, we are already globally in a borderless economy as a result of the expansion of world markets, intensifying especially of the role of financial markets in the world economy. Omai says the era of the nation state is over. His book, you remember, I referred to on the book list, called The End of the Nation State. In there he says nation state is just a fiction for us now. It is simply a relic of the past. It has no role in the new globalized marketplace. For Omai, therefore, we're not only experiencing processes of globalization, they have already transformed the basic institutional structures of the society in which we live. As a consequence, most of the politics linked to that kind of society, Omai says, and others like him say, are obsolete. If you ask, for example, why many people say they're no longer interested in politics, or why people feel that politicians have become irrelevant to their lives, as many do, Omai has a very straightforward answer. Politics has become irrelevant to most people's lives because governments do not have any significant power in the global economy. This is simply a new globalized order in which the old forms of political power, including social democracy, including the idea of protecting the poor, for example, through the welfare state, these things have simply become obsolete. The Omai type view, if you look at the European Union, would say, well, the European Union must change. The old social democratic welfare system is simply anarchic, simply antique in the context of the new demands of the global marketplace. So there are very, very big issues involved here. Now, I'd like to suggest to you that neither of these two positions are correct, but each has a certain element of validity in it. I think, like the hyper-globalizers, that we are in a period of intense globalization. I think this is true. But I think we have to look at what this concept means and what it's spell out its main dimensions, if you like. However, unlike Omai, I think we're in the early phases of a process of intensifying globalization. And we're still shaping the sort of global society which will emerge from this. To develop these points, I'd like to just briefly list some key aspects of what I take to be processes of globalization today, so that at least you can get my arguments clear in your own mind. Just enumerate a number of points. First, in my view anyway, globalization processes today, globalizing processes, are not just an extension of the age-old tendency of modernity to spread across the world. Modernity, modern industrial capitalist civilization, the West, if you like, has long been expansionary. Marx had a theory of that expansionist tendency of the West. According to Marx, and this is something we'll look at a bit next time again, it's primarily because of the exigencies of the capitalist economy. The capitalist economy is an economy which always demands change, which is eternally restless and always has to acquire new markets, cheapen its products, draw more people in. Thereby, it spreads across the world and destroys other cultures with which it comes into contact. This is undoubtedly in some part true. Modernity always has had this globalizing implication. Very clear if you compare the past 200 years history of Western civilization with, say, the history of traditional China. Traditional China was a very large world historical civilization, but it was by and large not expansionary. It did not seek to take over the world in the way in which the West has done from as early as the 17th century onwards. It's quite right to say, therefore, I think, that modernity is expansionary, that globalization is implied in modernity. However, the current period of modernity is different, I think, anyway. For various reasons, one main reason is that it is no longer so dominated by the West. Of course, the West, the industrial nations, still have a key power role in the global system. But over the past 20 or 30 years, we're increasingly talking of decentered globalization. Decentered globalization is globalization which nobody controls, which impacts back on Western societies, which is altering the geopolitical shape of world power, and which is strongly influenced by the impact of intensified financial exchanges worldwide, but not solely dominated by them. The era of decentered globalization is also the era, I think, of the rise of manufactured uncertainty or manufactured risk, and among other things, financial markets are deeply implicated in the rise of these new uncertainties, although, of course, you can't blame all such uncertainties on them. So first, I would like to claim, much as the hyperglobalizers claim, I think, this is a new period of development of globalization, which is shifting the very structures of the world, and certainly is influencing the Western countries as much as it is other parts of the world, the so-called non-developed world, the Asian economies, South America, and so forth. Second, it's a mistake, I think, to identify globalization thus understood, decentered globalization, as purely an economic phenomenon. As Marx spotted, and is still true today, economic change does have tremendous driving force. If you look over the past 20 or 30 years, there's no doubt that economic change is very important in intensified globalization. In two respects, really, the creation of a more integrated global marketplace, and second, again, the dominant role which financial markets tend to have over the global economy. The increasing power of financial markets, I think, is one of the most evident features of recent globalization, and to me, it's not the same as was true of the late 19th century, for reasons which, if I get time, I'll try to spell out later or maybe next time. However, that having been said, that saying that the globalization of the marketplace, influence of financial markets that absolutely nobody controls, no nation controls them, George Soros doesn't control them, nobody controls global financial markets, they're like some gigantic intelligence, you know, if you like them, they're a sort of perceptive intelligence, if you don't like them, they're kind of baleful casino-type mentality, you know, of the global economy. Whatever you make of it, they are not controlled by anybody. That is what decentered globalization, for better or for worse, means. But it is a mistake simply to treat globalization as economic in each of these senses. I'd like to suggest to you that the best way to understand globalization is as follows. We are, I think, the first generation to be living in the emergent period of something like a global cosmopolitan society. A society which is different from any other previous society in history, which is certainly not confined to the nation state, which has new structures, new institutional forms, which we're still learning about and we're still trying to cope with, but which is far more than just an economic order. We have to speak not just of economic globalization, but globalization along a range of other dimensions as well, political, cultural, and other dimensions I'll explain a bit later on. We are looking to see what the shape of the new global cosmopolitan order will be, I think. This is, again, one of the prime tasks of the social sciences at the turn of this century, and I'll have a great deal more to say about this in what follows in subsequent lectures. Third, it's also a great mistake to see globalization as just something about the big systems of the world. When you think about globalization, you think, well, you must mean something that stretches across the whole world. Well, this may be the case, but the best way to understand globalization is that it is a new relationship between our everyday lives and larger scale systems which both impact on our everyday life, but in reverse, which our lifestyle habits themselves also govern or determine. We are a new generation, I think. We are living in this world where planetary systems impact very directly on our personal lives. We all know this, for example, through the impact of financial markets, but where also, for the first time, I think, in human history, simple lifestyle decisions, like buying a can of beans or buying a shirt, have consequences for the global economic order. That is what globalization means. Globalization, I'd like to suggest to you, is therefore an in-here phenomenon, not just an out-there phenomenon. If you want to trace out what it means, you have to trace it out on the level of everyday life. It even involves a tremendous impact on our personal lives, on our emotional lives, on our sexual lives. The impact on sort of the emotions of late modernity is something I'll be looking at in a subsequent lecture. Globalization is about the new interaction between the local and the global, if you like. And that interaction is different from what it was in previous ages. Why? Well, fourthly, or whatever the next point would be, above all, because of the impact of new communication systems. If you ask what are the determining or at least major factors that separate off the period of decentered globalization from preceding periods, you have to say the impact of the new marriage between information technology, computerization, and new communications technologies is one of the key drivers. Only since the setting up of a global satellite system, which is only about 30 or so years ago, only since then has it been possible for there to be instantaneous communication across the face of the Earth. Instantaneous communication is not just a way in which news is communicated more quickly or information is communicated more quickly. It actually changes structures. A very obvious example of this, in fact, is financial markets. Globalized, electronic, 24-hour, real-time financial markets have only been possible since this convergence of technologies. But they influence deeply our way of life. We live in a heavily mediatized society in which the role of media and communications, especially electronic media and communications, is much, much greater than it ever was before. You see its influence in politics, and you see most notably, you know, kind of amazing, absolutely amazing phenomena of Princess Diana's, I should say, life and death. The death of Princess Diana was a global media event. Her life was a media narrative. We were all part of that narrative, I think, whether we liked her or otherwise. Her death was a kind of emotional shock for people who were caught up in that narrative. A certain sense probably in which we knew more, most of us knew more about Princess Diana than we might know about close friends. Very, very strange world in which to live, that is. You might also consider the issue of violence, which I'll be raising a bit later in this course, because we also live in a world of mediated violence. Enormous amount of violence carried in new electronic communication. At the same time, the sort of structures of violence in the world are shifting. Most people will have been to the cinema and seen violent films, but very few people here will have ever seen a dead body, for example. Sequestration or the separation of death from view is a sort of key part of late modernity. And yet you have this visibility of death through the electronic media. All these are part of what I would define anyway as globalization. Fifthly or sixthly, whatever the next point would be, globalization is a set of processes, not a single process, and it operates in contradictory or oppositional fashion. It's again a mistake to think of globalization as a one-way, single, say, economic process. It is a complicated set of processes which operate in different directions simultaneously. I think if you want to draw a shape, I think it's a good idea to think of a kind of shape for globalization. If you want to draw it, it would look like this. First of all, if you consider the nation state, globalization economically pulls away from the nation state, just like Omai says it does. Globalization, in other words, takes away some of the economic power which nation states in the Keynesian era could still exert. At the same time as it pulls upwards into the global economy, however, globalization processes push downwards. They push downwards because you get new forms of pressure for local autonomy, for regionalization, for downward pressure below the nation state, if you like, as a key part of what globalization does. So if you ask why there are, for example, large number of local areas that want their own national identity, why is local nationalism, sub-nation state nationalism so important, it's largely because of the downward pressure of globalization. If you want a more homely thing and you ask whether it's any sense for Tony Blair to talk about a recovery of community, well, it's not completely senseless because the downward pressure means pressure towards local democracy, local devolution of power, and therefore potentially the regeneration of local neighborhoods, or so I think anyway. Come back to that theme later. Globalization therefore pulls upwards, pushes downwards. At the same time, however, the third sort of visual aspect of it squeezes sideways. And Omai is very good in his discussion of this. Squeezes sideways in the sense in which it creates new economic social regions which cross-cut often the boundaries of nation states. Very good example of such a flattened region is the area around Barcelona in northern Spain, which extends over into France. The economy of Catalonia is strongly integrated in the European Union. It is both part of Spain, yet an autonomous province within Spain with a great deal of local power. It is not simply an area within Spain because it overlaps a very substantial, quite integrated economic area. Omai also gives the example of the Hong Kong, Southwest China area, where the same thing applies. Think of Hong Kong as it used to be, a separate colonial state. Well, for the last few years, it hasn't been true. You've had much more of an integrated economic area, cross-cutting the border there. Very interesting example of this, actually, very relevant to things going on at the moment, is Northern Ireland and Ireland. If you look at economic integration between Northern Ireland and Ireland proper, there's been a tremendous expansion of economic integration. There is a strong economic area that cross-cuts the border between Northern Ireland and Ireland itself. And that surely must be one kind of economic platform for the peace negotiations that are now going on in Northern Ireland. In sum, if you want to ask what globalization means and you want a conceptualization of it, I would conceptualize it as follows. Globalization is above all about what I would call, anyway, the expanding role of action at distance. Globalization refers to the fact that distant events make a much more direct and immediate impact on our lives today than was ever possible before. But conversely, individual lifestyle decisions make a much more direct impact on global systems than was ever true previously. To put it in a more fundamental sense, what action at distance means is really transformation of space, and bound up with that, transformation of time. Globalization is about an altered relationship to space, particularly under the impact of modern electronic technologies, communication systems. But a transmuted relation to space is also a new relationship to time. I mentioned in the first lecture that the idea of the news was a 19th century creation of the first form of electronic technology, the emergence of the Morse code. The idea of the news only arises about that time. News has a different relationship to space from previous transmission of information, because what's important about the news is not where it comes from, but when it comes. News has to be new by definition. We live in a society, I feel, where there is global electronic communication, where the notion of news has become even more flattened, and where therefore our relationship to our history has become pretty dramatically transformed. Our history tends to exist for us as heritage, as theme parks, as kind of transmuted tradition, but not as organically lived history. This is even true of life histories, I think, in a way I'll talk about in a subsequent lecture. The impact of global electronic transformation of technology is to produce an even more flattened version of the news, which has very strong impacts in politics, for example. A lot of politics now consists of instantaneous reaction to events, where that reaction then becomes the news. I don't know how many people here are up in time or lying in bed listening to the Today program on BBC Four. Well, it's really interesting because the Today program, which is listened to by a lot of people in this country, actually constitutes the news as it reports it. So you get someone who is interviewed on the Today program by John Humphreys early on, and then in the next news item, this is reported as news. So-and-so said, this is the case, this then becomes a news item. This is the what our experience becomes like in this era of global electronic transformation. Now, when I was looking at the emergence of a global cosmopolitan society, and you're asking, what are the institutional dimensions of this society? You can work them out by looking at the main institutional dimensions of modernity itself and see how these have become globalized in the recent era. So let me just sort of draw these up for you. Got somewhat more complex institutional differentiation. By the way, I do apologize about how hot and horrible it is in here. I'll try and make sure that whatever system of ventilation there is working next time, because it's obviously pretty horrible in here at the moment, I think, but I'll still plod on if you don't mind, nevertheless. Slightly more complex institutional breakdown of modernity than that offered in the first lecture. You can say that modernity from its beginnings has four institutional dimensions. First of all, the impact of the economic system of capitalism. Capitalism means a market economy, buying and selling commodities on a market. One of the driving forces of the emergence of modernity, as Marx quite rightly pointed out. However, you can separate this from industrialism, at least analytically. Industrialism means the use of mechanical technologies to affect our relationship to nature, whether these technologies be steam, electricity, or now today, microchip circuitry. These, in turn, you can separate from the emergence of the modern state. Whoever talks of the modern state is talking of the nation state. As I'll be explaining in a subsequent lecture, the nation state is unique to modernity. The nation state is as much a part of early modernity as capitalism or industrialism are. Third, you have a partly independent dimension of military power, about which Marx didn't have so much to say, but the famous German sociologist Max Weber, a generation later, wrote a lot. Military power is not just an extension of these other dimensions. Force and violence have played a partly independent role in world history, as we all know. Now, when you consider the current era of globalization, you can trace out, by the way, all these would have at the backdrop the sort of driving force of Enlightenment culture and the role of science and technology as a way of looking at the world and trying to understand the world. It infuses all these dimensions, really. Today, you have a world capitalist economy shaped by the forces I just mentioned. A world capitalist economy increasingly influenced by information, electronic information, increasingly dominated by global financial markets. If you can read my writing, you have an international division of labor. International division of labor refers to the productive activities of different enterprises across the world. Different industries are linked to one another in trading relationships across the world. Different things are produced in different parts of the world, and so on. You have still a global nation-state system. And you have still a global military order, an order of uneasy military alliances of the sort we see creaking into action at this very moment or attempting to do so in the Middle East. I'd like to argue that as a result of intensifying globalizing processes over the past 20 or so years, 20 or 30 years, all of these are undergoing major transformation. When we speak of the emergence of a global cosmopolitan society, we're talking about big transformations in each of these global systems, and we're talking about big transformations in the way in which they impact on our personal lives as well. Each of these has a double side. Each supplies, I think, certain ideals of what the good society would be like, and each has created new forms of uncertainty, risk, or problematic for us. The world capitalist economy, Marx's diagnosis, I think he was correct, goes along with large-scale economic inequality on a global scale. Large-scale economic inequality, a capitalist market system tends to produce a polarization between the winners and losers in the global economy. At the moment, a lot of the losers are in Africa. Africa is easily the poorest continent in the world, for whatever reason. Tremendous global stratification. One of the big, big problems facing the world is global poverty. About 20% of the world's population live in conditions of absolute or subsistence poverty. International division of labor, in other words, our relationship with nature and industry, underlies the ecological crisis which we face. We face a crisis of unknown dimensions in respect of industrial pollution, but more generally, the transformation of nature by modern industry. You have to include within this the new genetics, the impact of science. All these are producing a world where nature is no longer nature. The true scale of the ecological crisis is a scale of how to live in a world where nature is no longer nature. If you think of what we eat, hardly anything of what we eat is natural any longer. And the very idea of natural food takes on a kind of perverse attraction. Organic farming is a kind of counteraction to the end of nature, but that is also something that exists after the end of nature too, I feel. Because the modern state of a crisis of human rights, which is related to global democratizing processes. I'm going to devote a whole lecture to the impact of global democratization, its limits and its possibilities later. The modern state, however, can be a highly repressive apparatus of power. And again, what's going on in the Middle East is not unrelated to that. Military power created, as we all know, weapons of mass destruction of the very kind that not just Saddam is said to possess, but several of the major Western powers and other countries also possess. Don't make the mistake of supposing that the world is safer with the disintegration of the bipolar standoff between the US and the Soviet Union. The problem of proliferation of nuclear weapons and the problem of proliferation of other weapon systems, fundamental problem for the global society. Now, each of these, I would say, supplies ideals to live for, and therefore, while at the same time we face all these tremendous problems in the global order, we also have a kind of global energy, I feel. It's not in any sense, I think, purely a word to be pessimistic about. In respect of capitalism, we at least can consider the prospect, the desirability, of creating a world which is both wealthy and which is at least far more equal than the world is now. The ideal of equality is still a mobilizing force, I think, in world society. The idea of sustaining a harmonious relationship to nature surely has to be an energizing ideal of the good society for us at the end of the 20th century. The ideal of a society which recognizes the rights of its citizenry, which protects human rights on an international level, again, surely a guiding ideal of democratization, itself one of the positive forces of 20th century world history. And finally, a world where people live harmoniously with one another. In other words, a cosmopolitan world free from the threat of violence is again surely a world to be striven for. You have here, therefore, I think, the main ideals of political betterment which are still alive in the world. The problem for us, if I can put it this way, at the end of the 20th century, very much related to what I'm going to talk about next time, the collapse of Marxism, is how to actualize these ideals in a world where the Enlightenment promise has turned partly sour. I go right back to Marx in this. Very interesting to think of Marx's own ideas as a kind of energizing movement. I mean, Marx was not just a theorist of the economic basis of capitalism. Marx was a political thinker who did have some notion of an ideal society to which one should move. In the early Marx, these ideals were linked to a kind of secularized religion. You know, Marx was very critical of organized and orthodox religion. And many people think that Marx was therefore had no interest in religion, but this is not true. There's a famous part in the early writings of Marx where Marx says religion is the opium of the people. Religion is the opium of the people. Many interpreters, critical or otherwise, think therefore Marx is saying, well, religion is a wholly negative force, and all the ideals which go along with religion should be jettisoned. But Marx was never saying that. Marx was arguing that the ideals embodied in religious thinking or some aspects of it can become realizable. They can become part of the project of modernity. They supply the ideals for a society to which we should move. Right after the time where he says religion is the opium of the people, Marx says the following poignant things. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature, he says. Religion is the sigh of the oppressed creature. Religion is the heart of a heartless world. He wanted to retrieve the heart of the heartless world. He wanted to show that the world can be improved. The problem for us is who will now hear the sigh of the oppressed creature in a world seemingly dominated by rampant capitalist markets. This itself connects with the issue of the dissolution of socialism, disintegration of Marxism, and collapse of the Soviet Union. All these things I hope to compress into 1 hour in the lecture next time, and I do apologize for the physical suffering which being here today is involved, but I suppose I was involved with it as well as you. Thanks very much anyway.